My name's Amelie. I'm an alcoholic. I'm really nervous. I haven't told my story before, so I have a little script. So I had 13 months a couple weeks ago. last time I spoke in front of a group, I was super wasted at my best friend's wedding. Okay. So, a little backstory. So I had my first drink when I was 13. Within 3 years, I got my first DUI. And I think that was like the first red flag was legal trouble. That was like my family's first red flag anyway. Consequently, as far like there was fines and stuff like that, but then I had to start seeing a therapist that was gonna assess my drinking, and she told me one day that I'm never gonna be able to drink normally, and I was 16 at the time, and she told me that I was an alcoholic, and then I started to just lie to her because I felt like she was taking away my life. I don't know. I felt like she was, you know, taking away my what I felt like I was entitled to do as a 16-year-old. Through high school, my drinking progressed until I had an eating disorder at the end of high school. Drinking got in the way of restricting calories, so I couldn't drink. And then freshman year in college, I ditched the eating disorder and decided to binge food and alcohol. So it was kind of like a balance between a lot of different ways that I was experiencing my addict behavior. Exchanging addiction for addiction. Then I started spending money that I didn't have. I was sleeping with people to make me feel better about myself while trying to get a college degree. And then I made it to jail. Six months before my 21st birthday. After blacking out, trying to drive myself from place to place after drinking. House arrest and jail and fines followed, and my family was devastated. And I'm really not the type that functions well 30 days in jail. I was a puddle the entire time. So 6 or 7 months after jail time and house arrest and, DUIs are just expensive and whatever. And my mom had to see me in orange. She tells me still how traumatizing that was to her. I started drinking and driving again 6 or 7 months after my second DWI. But I wasn't just drinking and driving. I was like drinking and everything. I was drinking and going to school. I was drinking and going to work. I was drinking at work. I was blacking out shifts. I was drinking and relationships. I was drinking and drugs. My entire life was alcohol. And it happened so fast. It took me 10 years to come to the conclusion that I can't live and properly function with alcohol and drugs in my life, or anything that really gives me happy feels. I like to spend money, and I like to do everything in excess. I was desperate for help, but I didn't really know what to do about that. So since it's gratitude night, I just wanted to kind of highlight the little toolbox that we talk about in treatment, and two of my favorite tools. One being community or the fellowship. Without the people in my life, I wouldn't have a job or be able to pay my rent on time or be a licensed driver. I lean when I don't want to, and when I do want to, I lean on a lot of people. I tell on myself all the time, no matter how silly it may feel. I ask for help more often than I want to. The cushion this program possesses is wild. It's seriously beautiful. I find my higher power when I speak with other alcoholics and addicts. I just say all of my thoughts because it's kind of my way. If I tell on myself, if I say, hey, I want to drink because of this or because of that, it's like a way of, I can get it out of my head, but B, it gets me talking with another person that thinks the same way that I do, and then I feel less alone. Walking into a room of addicts makes me feel like I'm a part of something, and that's another piece that I never felt growing up. So that's really cool, too. Another really important thing to me is sponsorship. Sometimes I feel like I show up really shitty as a sponsee, but that's not a thing. It's just like something I decided that I suck. I work my program. I've been through treatment 2 times. I work my program with someone who's been through the steps more than once, and I intend on continuing through my steps one day at a time, but I intend on continuing to do my steps. And I take suggestions even when they aren't the suggestions that I want. Sobriety is a gift. I don't know how long I've been talking, but I was a puddle. I was desperate for help, but I was ready to drink myself to death before I was ready to help myself. I didn't know how to help myself. This wouldn't have been possible without my higher power, without the support of other recovering addicts and alcoholics. And the last little piece I wanted to mention is it's been really important for me to remind myself that I'm no different than everyone in this room. I'm no worse, I'm no better. The things that I think aren't crazy, they're not ludicrous. This program has just shown me like such a peace that I have never felt within myself, and I strive to live to be worthy of that peace every single day. So with that, I'll pass.
Hello, my name is Terry. I'm an alcoholic. Boy, I love that when you say that back to me, because it reminds me of when I was relatively new in the program. I was more concerned about my anonymity than I was about getting sober and staying sober or working the program or any of that stuff. I was just worried somebody'd find out that I was going to those A&A meetings. So I went to Uptown at the time. I'd go down walking down Summit Avenue like I was out for a walk, and then just kind of skitter up the steps and hope nobody saw me. So early in my sobriety, I was in a meeting at work. There were about 15, 20 people in a room seated around. And the person leading the meeting says, "Let's go around and introduce ourselves." Yeah. And I thought, oh, I know I'm going to say, my name is Terry and I'm an alcoholic. I know I'm going to. Well, it got to be my turn, and I said my name and I said what I did, and I sat down, and the lady next to me introduced herself, says, "My name is Sue. I work with the Department of Health." And I said, "Hi, Sue." And it was interesting to see the looks on the faces of the people in the room. She jumped about 2 feet off the ground. But there was one guy over in the corner. "Hey, I know where you've been going, bud." So anyway, I'm so grateful to be here on Gratitude Night. Seems appropriate. I'm grateful for so many things, and that should become apparent as I go on with my story. I want to first a few of the particulars. My sobriety date is May 21st, 1984. I've been married to this lovely lady for the last 52 years, and she's a big part of my recovery. Now that I'm retired, I go to 6 meetings a week. I have a sponsor I meet with every Tuesday morning, and I sponsor a number of men. And I'm just so grateful for what this program has given me. My story, and thank you, Amelie, for sharing your story. That was awesome. My story goes back to, I was born and raised in a town south of here, Rochester, Minnesota. At the time, it was a little smaller back when I was a kid. It was about 25,000 people. And it was a bunch of the neighborhood I was in were pretty much guys who had just gotten out of the service after World War II and started families. And we just had wonderful neighborhood. I had so many friends. I had a family I knew loved me. I had really an ideal childhood. The only problem seemed to be that I was there. And my perception was that I had a case of what I call the killer bees. Should be, could be, and want to be. Just wasn't enough. I was just not good enough, not smart enough, not good-looking enough, not strong enough, not fast enough, just not enough. At age 12, one of the neighborhood boys' family was out of town. He was about 3 years older than I was. I went over to his house, and we went down his basement. We were shooting pool with our sunglasses on because we were cool. And he brought out a bottle of gin and a bottle of Pepsi. And we polished that off. Yeah, I hear the gasps about that, and people, as if. I mean, come on. I shared that in a meeting one time at the Uptown House, and a guy who had just told the story about drinking Listerine goes, "Oh, gin and Pepsi." So anyway, I got drunk. Drunks lose their car often when they drink and get drunk. I lost my house. I couldn't find my way back across the street first time. I ended up passing out on the boulevard and waking up as the sun was coming up. I was laying on the boulevard. I'd peed my pants and thrown up on myself, and I got up, and I remember thinking, that was so much fun, and I can't wait to do it again. And because that alcohol, when it went into me, it hit me, and it filled up all the holes. And I went from being not enough to being too much in a very short period of time. So anyway, that's how I drank through high school. I didn't drink all the time, but when I did drink, that's the way I drank. And left Rochester and came up here to the Twin Cities to go to the university and got married, started a family, went to school. Cheryl worked. I went to school. Cheryl worked. I went to school. Cheryl worked. Finally graduated and started a career, and during that time, my alcohol use just kept increasing, the frequency with which I was drinking, so that about the last 5 years, I was drinking pretty much every night, and the pattern was that I would wake up in the morning with my head in the toilet, and I was sick and shaken, and And, I was done. I'm quit. I quit. I'm not going to drink anymore. You know, a friend of mine who was in the program is now living in Florida used to say that quitting was easy. You know, he'd do it 3 or 4 times in one day. It's stay and quit that's the problem. And I would, about 10 o'clock, the fog would lift, and I'd realize that I was probably a little bit hasty in my assessment of the situation earlier in the day, that I could probably drink if I kept it at 2 tonight. And so I would think about that, and then all afternoon I'd think about those 2 I was going to have when I got home from work. 5 o'clock I'd get home. By 5:30 I'm mixing my third drink. The next morning I got my head in the toilet and blacked out, wonder what happened. And I did that over and over, and that's how my drinking manifests itself. Then one day I got a call from Cheryl. She called me and said, "Come home, I got to talk to you." And something was wrong here. So I went home, and she confronted me with my. She said, "Let's go for a walk, first of all." And to this day, when she says, "Let's go for a walk," I kind of, do we have to? And on that walk, she confronted me with my drink. She says, I'm concerned about your drinking. I think you may have an alcohol problem. I want you to go in. I made arrangements for you to go and get evaluated over the noon hour." And I looked at her and I said, "Honey, I don't need an evaluation. I know I'm an alcoholic." I didn't say that because I really believe that. I just wanted to get the heat off. You know, the last thing I wanted to do was go in and have some guy make it official. Even though I had some concerns about my drinking. So I looked at her and said, "Honey, I'm an alcoholic. You know, I know I am." And she looked up to me, those beautiful blue eyes of hers, and says, "Well, I don't know what you're going to do, but I'm going to go to Al-Anon." Now, I didn't know what Al-Anon was, but very deep in the base of my brain, the red light started flashing. They said, "Whatever this Al-Anon is, isn't going to be good for Terry." And as it turns out, it was the best thing that could have happened because she brought recovery into our house. And I stopped drinking, but I just, I didn't really get involved in the program, and she kept going to Al-Anon, and I didn't drink, but I, you know, went through a number of years of sobriety where I didn't drink, but I didn't go to meetings, She went to Al-Anon and something happened. The kids and I figured she'd go to these meetings, they rewired her, you know, so that when we pushed the buttons, we didn't get the same reaction we always got, you know. That was it. One of the things I like to do with her, one of my favorite activities with Cheryl was to argue. And I don't have to, I'll take either side, just tell me the issue and let's go. So we were arguing, and she's going to meetings, and we started arguing, and went back and forth a couple times, and then she said, "Well, you may be right." "Well, that's cheating. Where does that come from?" So anyway, and she started getting happy, she started getting well, and I stayed pretty sick, and then the disease came in and grabbed our son by the throat, and he went from being the All-American boy, Honor Society, just a great, you know, just an All-American kid, to the thing that lived upstairs in about 2 years, or a year and a half, actually. Very quick. And we had him, put him in treatment, went to Family Week, did all that stuff. And he came back. He transformed. I couldn't believe he's back to being the kid he was. I remember one night sitting at the table with him and saying, "Well, you know, you've been going to what are they doing? What seems to work for you?" He says, "Well, you know, Dad, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path." And he recited it because he'd memorized it in treatment. And watching what happened to him, said, "I better go to AA." So he, by the way, he's one of our 2 children who suffer from the disease, both of our children. One of the arguments we had early on in sobriety was which we had a statistical chance of one of our children being alcoholic. We figured it was about 50% chance. And we argued about which one it was going to be. Cheryl thought it would be our daughter, and I thought it would be our son. And one of the spiritual principles that came true early in our recovery was that we were both right. They were both alcoholics. We refer to them as our little thoroughbreds. At any rate, My son, fortunately, they found recovery. My son went into that treatment, and at age 17, he just celebrated 31 years of sobriety, and is goes to the meeting up in Superior, Wisconsin, the Serenity Club in Superior. If you're ever up there, drop in. It's a great group. And my daughter just celebrated 21 years, I think, in the program. So this thing is just amazing. And talk about gratitude for this program. So anyway, I went to my first meeting at Uptown. I went in, walked in the room, and I sat down, and they said, "Is there anybody for here for their first, you know, relative new to the program?" I said, "I am." I raised my hand. They said, "Well, we'll have a first step meeting." And I said, "Hey, you don't have to do that for me." And they said, "We're not." So they got me off for the first right step. And they had their first step meeting, and I didn't know much about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. All I knew that at the end of that meeting is that those folks knew me. They knew how I thought. They knew how I believed, what I believed. They knew me right down to my soul. I didn't understand the program, but I knew that. And they seemed happy, and that gave me hope. And I just kept coming back. And so then I came back, and I did what we're supposed to do. You know, I got a sponsor, started working the steps and doing the things that we're supposed to do. That was what I was like. What happened, my sponsor told me early on that when I share, that I'm supposed to share what I've learned. He didn't really care what I thought. He wants to know, what did you learn? When we the very first meeting I had with him down at the St. Clair Broiler, he said, I can see that you have an active mind. And I thought, he didn't say brilliant. He didn't say exceptional. He didn't say incisive. He didn't say anything I was hoping he would say. So I made the mistake of asking him, when you said had an active mind, what do you mean? He says, "Well, that means that the wheel's still turning, but the hamster's dead." And he told me that he does not really care what I think about anything. It's what am I doing? And he got me off on the right foot. So what I've some things I've learned. The first step, I learned what was wrong with me. You know, I knew. For me, this program has been one of awareness, acceptance, and action. And the first step, you know, I'd been aware that I was had been drinking different than other people for some time before I got to the program. And but I thought for the longest time my problem was a moral problem. If I would just, what's wrong with me? If I had more willpower, I wouldn't do this. What's wrong? I did it again. And I would, you know, I learned in this program that's not my problem. My problem isn't a moral problem. I thought it was a bad habit I picked up, you know. So I went about the task as is outlined in the big book and the things that we try to control and enjoy our drinking. So I set upon a plan where I had set the standard was that, you know, three drinks a day, anything more than three drinks a day, I was an alcoholic. Well, I don't know where I got that. I made that up, I guess. I thought it was from the Bureau of Standards in Washington, you know, some kind of official thing. But I set about, I'm going to limit myself to three drinks a day, you know. And so the first thing I did was get the appropriate drinking vessel, you know. And I know I paid enough attention in science class in high school to know that ice displaces volume. So I drank everything warm, just to keep it under three drinks, you know, didn't want to be an alcoholic. And I really went about drinking a quart of brandy a day in three drinks, and geez, that felt good not to be an alcoholic. So obviously that doesn't work. You know, watching these things that we try to control and enjoy our drinking, it's sort of perversely entertaining in a way. It's like watching a dog eat a caramel, you know. It's just kind of messy. And anyway, so that didn't work. It wasn't a bad habit I picked up, and I can't teach myself how to drink responsibly. So I thought it was, you know, my environment, who I was with. You had my family, you had my job, you had this, blah, 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 blah. Well, that wasn't it. I didn't really pull any geographics, but I sure heard about them in here. People have pulled geographics and moved and tried to change their circumstances, and they unpacked their bags, and the alcoholism came along. So what I learned is that I've got the disease of alcoholism. That's my problem. I'm powerless over alcohol because I have the disease of alcoholism. And then people went on to teach me the five P's of alcoholism. Number one, it's powerful. Number two, it's permanent. Number three, it's progressive. Number four, it's primary. And number five, it's patient. And it's powerful. All you have to do is listen to our stories. Look at how far we'll chase this stuff. It's very powerful. My goodness, the things that we'll do. I remember one time in the last 5 years of my drinking, one of those mornings that I got up with my head in the toilet and shaking, and I got up and I dragged myself to work because if I went to work, I wasn't an alcoholic. That was one of my, couldn't be. So I got up and I was shaving, I was shaking, and I just felt miserable, and I cut myself, and it wasn't going well. Dragged myself down, got in my car, drove into work, got on the elevator, and there was a guy on the elevator. And he looked over at me and said, "Rife night, huh?" And I said, "Oh, it's none of your business. What are you, rough night? How, rough night?" I was shaking and probably reeked of alcohol. Got off the elevator on my floor, and across is a bank of windows right across, and I caught my reflection. And on my face, I had like a half roll of toilet paper from where I'd cut myself. not rip off a corner of a piece of toilet paper. And that stuff, boom. So I'm sitting there looking. I'm looking at myself in the mirror. Look at myself in that window. I'm just looking at myself saying, "This is pathetic. Look at you. Look at you. What is the matter with you?" And I had a moment of clarity, And that very night, I went out and bought an electric razor. Drank for three more years. That's powerful. That's a powerful delusion there that I'm capable of. I learned that it's permanent, and it says that in the big book, that we have this allergy to alcohol. When alcohol goes into me, something happens. Doesn't happen to 90% of the folks out there who use the product. 90% of the folks don't get that feeling of ease and comfort that I get. All you have to do is talk to them and watch them drink. They don't... you start talking to somebody about the ease and comfort that you feel when you drink, or that I get. And it's kind of, when you're talking to normal people, it's like talking to your cat, Oh. How fascinating for you, I'm going to go over here and shred the curtains. When you talk to an alcoholic about what that feeling of ease and comfort is like talking to your dog, they're, yeah. They're jumping up on you, slobbering on your pants. It's a different experience. So that's part of the identity. People understand that. So I have that permanent reaction, and it's gonna. I believe the next time I drink, I'll have that same reaction. I don't care how long I'm sober. Alcohol is going to do something different to me than it does to most people. It's also progressive, and I thought that was something that the old timers told just to scare us when we came in. The disease progresses whether you drink or not. Really. Stick around long enough and you watch. I haven't seen anybody who went out after, a year, 2 years, 5 years, actually somebody after 30 years go out. They don't come back and say, I went out drinking again, and after about 5-10 years, it got to be a problem again, so I came back. It's like falling off a cliff. You're back as bad as ever and worse in a very short period of time. It's primary. If I don't realize that my disease is something I have to deal with on a daily basis, if I don't put it first, anything I put before alcoholism, I lose. And I have to recognize that on a daily basis and remind myself I'm an alcoholic and act like I'm an alcoholic that wants to recover. It's also patient, and I view my disease, I personify it. It's a guy with a Panama hat. Looks a lot like Ed Harris, the actor. Got a Panama hat on. He's leaning against my car right now smoking a cigarette saying, "Go ahead and talk to those folks. I'm waiting for you. I'm here. Always here for you." So I learned that about the disease and what was wrong with me in step one. And then they said, okay, now you know what's wrong with you. Now let's get into the solution. And that's what the rest of the steps were. And I had problems with God, and as many do. I thought I was unique. And then, of course, I realized that they got a whole chapter called We Agnostics. They got a book called Came to Believe. A lot of people struggle with that and apparently have some new literature out there. about this struggle, this starting the spiritual journey. And I was just able to take the what's written in the 12 and 12, where it says, just be willing to believe it's possible, you know, and just move on. And I did that, and over time, the spirituality has, my concept of God and spirituality has changed. I now, one of the things that I preach about AA is nobody's ever told me what my God had to be. They didn't try to tell me God has to be this, and I've got to the point where for the longest time I would not use the word God because I was so averse to it, and I've got to the point where God is a term that is symbolic of something that I can't come up with for other words to describe. When I say God, I hope what pops up in your head is your concept of God, and when you say God, what pops up in my head is my concept of God. And so moved on and went down some blind alleys with God. One was that I figured I had, I couldn't believe it until I understood it. It wouldn't work for me until I understood it. That's a blind alley. I don't, as if I had the candle power to understand the whole thing. And then I heard a lady, a speaker named Patty O from Laguna Beach, California, at Gopher State, I think, said one of these, said that any God that you can understand is not going to be big enough to meet your needs. And that made sense to me. That finally made sense. The other blind alley I went down is I imbued God with my character defects. That's really a kind of a dumb decision. I read somewhere a lady who's in the program said, you can be assured that you have created God in your own self-image if your God hates all the same people you hate. So, another blind alley. So anyway, finally, over time, I keep learning, and it's still a journey. Step three, I like the fact that I get to make a decision. I've always thought I just didn't have any choices, but I always have choices. The one thing that can't be taken away from me, regardless of what my circumstances are, is my ability to choose how I'm gonna respond. And as a result of this program, I do a lot less reacting, do a lot more responding. And that choice, I always have a choice. So when I get up and have a bad day going for me, I can choose to change it. Why don't I just change my mind, you know? So I have a choice, you know. Come to those dilemmas, I got a choice. Turn it over to God, or turn it over to Terry, and turn it over to Terry, and turn it over to Terry, and turn it over to Terry. So it usually works better if I turn it over to God. So I then went through the rest of the steps, and I want to spend a little time that I have left talking about what it's like now, because it's amazing. The amount of gratitude that I have for what this program has given me. It's given me a family life that I wouldn't and couldn't imagine. I've got Cheryl here and the kids and all the rest of the family, and it's just amazing what recovery does when it's in a house, what it does to a household. We have a common language we can speak. Oh, it's a safe language. Last week, Cheryl said something to me that was, I interpreted as being particularly unkind. And my response was to take my dinner dishes and throw them in the sink. Unfortunately, I was like 5 feet away from the sink when I threw them. And I stomped upstairs and went in my room and started the list of all of the things in the last 52 years she's done, which were unkind and unthoughtful and the like. And I was just up there, and about an hour later, the door opens and she comes in, and I thought, oh, yeah, it's about time we get an apology here. It's about time. And she came in and she wrapped her arms around me, hugged me, and said, I don't like it when we're mad at each other. Now, what are you supposed to do with that? I mean, what are you supposed to do with that? You mean we're not going to go back and relive the whole episode and put the context and rationalizations in there for my behavior? Don't I get to do that? No. Well, I don't like we're mad at each other either. And so that's it. That was the end of it. You know, that would have been about a 3 or 4 day deal in the past. But that's a real gift, and I'm so grateful for it. About 5 years ago, our daughter developed breast cancer. And she's underwent surgery, underwent chemo, underwent radiation, and one of the things I did before I retired is I was a physician, and I wanted to be her doctor because I was more comfortable in that role than I was of being her father. And you taught me how to be her father. She had good doctors. She had wonderful doctors. She didn't need me in her medical care. She needed me to be her dad. And you taught me how to do that. And apparently, being her dad in this circumstance meant accompanying her to her chemotherapy sessions over in Madison, Wisconsin, and telling dumb jokes, which I'm very good at, actually. I found one of the blessings and one of the things I'm grateful for, I got to go. She'd go in for chemo on Friday, Saturday morning was her routine meeting that she'd been going to for the last 20 years over in Baraboo, Wisconsin. Got to go to her meeting with her and see the people in that program carry her. To see them carry her through this, through, you know, feeling sick, her hair falling out, and all that. And fortunately, as you know, she's cancer-free at the five-year level, so we're grateful for that. But so much gratitude. About the same time, I was given the gift of sadness, learning how to experience sadness. Never could experience sadness. I would always turn it into anger, and I'd blame somebody or I'd blame myself for it. And to just have unencumbered sadness is just such a gift. My sister developed colon cancer and ended up dying. She was my little sister. She was 12 years. I was 12 years old when she was born, so I was like her favorite horse for the first 3 years. And I, you know, again, I wanted to go down and be her doctor, you know. I'm going to go down to the Mayo Clinic and tell those guys what they need to do. You know, but you know, she didn't need a doctor. Didn't need me doing that. She needed me to be her brother. And my job was to sit in hospice with her and hold her hand with her last days. What a gift. What a gift. And I'm so grateful for all that. And just to let you know that things are so much better, I have a gift of sponsorship. My sponsor is... I just love, and my sponsees, about a month ago, I was sitting with my sponsor explaining to him a highly finely honed resentment that I had developed and explaining why it was justified. And halfway through my explanation, he took his hearing aids out and put them on the table. And he said, Michael, what's that? Oh, I was hearing this high-pitched whine. I thought it was coming from my hearing aid. So, I still got a ways to go, I guess. I'll just close with a story that kind of tells you how fast I can unravel. This happened several years ago. We were invited to a wedding down in southern Minnesota, just a little above the Iowa border, and it was a beautiful summer day, and Cheryl and I got in the car, and we were driving down there. We stopped in Mankato for a wonderful lunch, and then we got on Mankato, and we were just driving. It was so beautiful, and Cheryl reached over and put in the ABBA CD, Mamma Mia CD. Well, we got to singing, and just, it was just joy, you know, singing. And I probably don't look like it, but I am the dancing queen. anyway, so we... we're bopping down the road, and pretty soon I realized we're going west. We're supposed to be going south. Okay, so they're right there. A little bit of background. I grew up, I believe there's like an 11th commandment, and the 11th commandment is, thou shalt not be late. And being late is being there any time less than 10 minutes early. So I realized we may be late. So I turned the car around, I whipped it, and we went back. And of course, during that time, I developed a big resentment against her because She put that ABBA CD in and got me distracted. If she'd been paying attention, I would have been able to pay attention and we would have gotten... So I'm going through that whole thing in my mind as we're driving. And we get to the turnoff and start heading south and pull up behind... Dad is taking the DeSoto out for a spin. He's going 35 miles an hour down this two-lane country road. And he put his blinker on, and 2 miles later he turned. And hey, so you old fool, you know, and I whipped out to pass him. He was actually younger than I was, but still. So I had a resentment against him for a while. Then we got to the town, just before the town we were going to, and they had closed the streets for festival days. They'd closed the main drag where this highway went through, so we were routed around town. So now I got a resentment against the whole town. You know, I'm sitting there thinking, look at that, isn't that great? We're trying to get there. They got a Ferris wheel and jackass rides or whatever they got going on down there. So we whip around the town. We have to make the detour. And I pull into a gas station because I was still in my shorts and T-shirt, and we had to dress. I brought my suit. I didn't. I had left it away. We're going to arrive in plenty of time for me to get dressed if it hadn't been for the ABBA CD. So we pull in the gas station. I run in, get kind of half dressed, and come running out and hop in the car. She said, "Cheryl, you got to drive. I got to finish dressing." Before that, when we got there, I was driving actually, and I started to undress because I realized I had to do it. So I'm driving 60 miles an hour, and I'm starting to take my shirt off, and Cheryl says, I say to Cheryl, "Hey, give me a hand here. I gotta change." So I'm in my shirt. And I don't know if you've ever been in a car when an Al-Anon detaches, but it's an experience. The car shivers, first of all. It just kind of, and she says, "You're nuts. I'm not doing that." And then sometimes the car will kill when she does that kind of stuff. But anyway, so... I jump in, I got dressed. We pulled up in front of the church, and there was a little embankment there right up by the side of the church. And I'd finished dressing in the car, and I bounded out of the car. I took a half step, and all of a sudden, I'm flung back onto the top of the car. And I was laying there looking up, and when I got dressed and put my belt on, I'd hooked it around the seat belt. So I'm laying there, looking up at the sky. She's bent over the hood laughing. That's a half an hour in the life of a maniac. What can I say? I mean, I can unreel so fast, but I was able to kind of look up and say, well, I guess God had to get a little, had to help me here. So anyway, I am so grateful to be here. This has been wonderful. As I said, I'm so full of gratitude for the program of AA. And with that, I'll pass. Thank you.